Mutual Defense Treaty. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will review all the areas where there is conflict and where this conflict may be leading to.
There seems to be no end at sight to tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, China's military announced it drove away a U.S. warship that it said illegally entered Chinese waters near the disputed Paracel Islands. It also urged Washington to stop such provocative actions. In reaction, the U.S. Navy claimed that the USS Benfold asserted navigational rights and freedoms in the vicinity of the Paracel Islands. It also dismissed China's claim of a serious violation of its sovereignty as false and a misrepresentation. The U.S. move coincided with the fifth anniversary of an international arbitral ruling that favored the Philippines and invalidated China's maritime claims in the South China Sea. Beijing has consistently dismissed the tribunal's finding. Regarding the occasion, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called on Beijing to stop what he called aggressive acts in the South China Sea. Blinken said that freedom of the seas was an enduring interest of all nations.
Nowhere is the rules-based maritime order under greater threat than in the South China Sea. The People's Republic of China continues to coerce and intimidate Southeast Asian coastal states, threatening freedom of navigation in this critical global thruway.
The South China Sea has become a major bone of contention between Beijing and Washington over the past years. The U.S. routinely sends warships and warplanes to the region to assert what it calls its right to freedom of navigation, ratcheting up tensions among the countries in the region. China has constantly warned the U.S. over its military activities in the contested waters. Beijing and Washington are also at odds over a range of issues, including China's policies with regard to Hong Kong and Taiwan, as well as their trade policies and origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Amid strained relations between the two sides, there have been fears that the South China Sea could emerge as a potential flashpoint. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under U.S. President Joe Biden, who succeeded Donald Trump in January. But a new administration has shown no sign of backing down on Trump's hard-line policies toward China.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, author and leading figure in the LaRouche movement and the Asia editor for the Executive Intelligence Review, Mike Billington, joins us from Hamilton, VA. Also joining us is journalist, author, and political analyst Daniel Lazar, who joins us from New York. All right, Daniel Lazar, let me first start with you. The U.S. has many problems with China. Obviously, we know that. Do you think that the U.S., generally speaking, initiates these problems, or is it the other way around? And then, in turn, why is the U.S. advancing or initiating these problems if the U.S. is guilty in the first place?
Well, it's very hard to say with regard to any specific incidents as to who initiates what. But there's no doubt the U.S. Regards itself as the global hegemon. It believes it has a right to patrol the South China Sea, a major causeway, choke point in terms of international trade. And it is up in arms over China's attempts to assert its own authority in its own coastal waters. I mean, if the shoe was on the other foot, there'd be no doubt the U.S. would be crying bloody murder if China proposed to regulate maritime traffic off the coast of California, for example. But the U.S. doesn't see it that way. So America's stance is very hostile, very aggressive, and China is determined not to be pushed around. So therefore, it is responding in kind. It's a very dangerous situation, which I think will very possibly lead to some kind of military conflict.
Do you agree with that, Mike Billington?
I think you have to start from the perspective that this is the same process that's going on in the Black Sea with this massive sea breeze exercise right on Russia's border. And of course, just days after Biden met with Putin in a small but extremely important positive step towards getting away from this push for military confrontation with both Russia and China. Within days of that, the British sent their warship, the Defender, into Russian waters off of Crimea, a provocation which could very well have led to war already and led the Russians to warn that a second incident of this sort will mean the sinking of the ship rather than warning shots. So these are going on simultaneously, but again, looking at Russia sort of as a parallel to this, Putin has made very clear when asked about what he thinks the U.S. policy is that you don't know because there's different factions in the U.S., even within the administration. There's no question but that Biden's personal impulse to want to have face-to-face diplomacy with Putin, and it was indicated by Kurt Campbell last week that chances are good that there will be a meeting with Xi Jinping even before the October G20 meeting. That this is a positive impulse from Biden, but as we know, presidents don't necessarily actually make policy in the United States. And the war party faction, where Blinken is clearly following in Pompeo's footsteps across the board, but there are differences with other networks. I think what happened just this last week, there was a celebration of the 50th anniversary of Henry Kissinger's secret visit to China that led to the Nixon visit. And Wang Qichan, probably the second or third most important Chinese official, at that meeting said that the biggest challenge for the United States is not China, it's the United States itself. It's a strategy towards China which must avoid forming a vicious circle of misleading and misjudgment. I believe this is the case. I would then point to what's happening in Afghanistan, which is extremely important after a 20-year absolute failure by the United States in every respect, not just in terms of the death and destruction, but a failed military effort. You now have a potential because the nations in the region have come together, emphatically China and Russia. There will be, in fact, a meeting this Friday in, I believe it's in Uzbekistan, which is going to involve Russia, China, Iran, India, and Turkey. And the President Khan of Pakistan and Ghani of Afghanistan will also be there. This is what Lyndon LaRouche has basically been demanding since 2001, since the foolish effort to blame 9/11 entirely on these guys off in a cave someplace, and to insist that rather than a war that had to lose in Afghanistan, we had to pull the nations, the regional nations together around a development program, that without development, Afghanistan will remain a graveyard for empires.
All right. Well, let's see here. I'm not too sure which conflict area I can ask you, Daniel Lazar. I mean, you know, I'm looking at the list and it's half a page here, so I don't know which one to start with because each one of them is a flashpoint between the U.S. and China. The most recent. Let me start with the most recent encounter, where you had basically, I guess it was a U.S. warship that was driven out from the South China Sea after Washington warned an attack on the Philippines might activate a mutual defense treaty. Tell us what that is and whether that is actually a flashpoint that could lead to a military confrontation, as some have said.
Well, the U.S. since 1951, I believe, has been in a mutual defense pact with the Philippines, and that therefore commits the U.S. to Philippines' defense in the event of some kind of foreign attack, most likely by China. So therefore, yes, it certainly could be, it could lead to a military flashpoint. But the point is the U.S. is pushing and probing, looking for Chinese weaknesses, trying to assert its own authority. And in so doing, it fairly guarantees that there will be a continuing escalation of these kinds of confrontations leading to some kind of outbreak. We don't know. But as your other guest said, the war party is clearly dominant in Washington. Anthony Blinken is very aggressive, and Biden himself is very aggressive as well. And they are looking to push China back, and China refuses to be pushed. So that's a very dangerous situation that's unfolding in the South China Sea.
Mike Billington, so tell us what the U.S. is thinking. I mean, you know, if there's a drawing board and you have a list of these flashpoints or hot-button topics or conflict areas that exist between the two. Is it really about that, or if we look at the bigger picture, is it about the U.S. trying to contain China, which it has said, believing that China is ahead, whether it's through its technology or through its economy, which many have said it's been widely reported for China to overtake the U.S. by the year 2028?
Well, that's certainly the case, but, you know, the LaRouche organization historically has always refuted this idea of trying to predict things, and instead poses what we as human beings should be doing to try to bring about a positive result. We now have a situation in which Biden, who, you know, he has very serious problems, cognitive problems, and he's surrounded by the military-industrial complex as Trump was, but he has this impulse to want to have face-to-face negotiations as he did with Putin. And as he had a two-hour phone call with Xi Jinping soon after he came in. So what we have to do to avoid the threat of a military confrontation between nuclear powers, which could very well end civilization as we know it, is to address how you solve these problems. Now, here again, the Afghanistan thing is crucial because it brings those nations together. And were the U.S. actually to support that approach, bringing the Belt and Road into Afghanistan, it would feed off immediately into this crisis in the South China Sea, an artificially created crisis, as your other guest said. You know, this is far away from the U.S. This is their territorial waters. But again, now you have a situation where Duterte, as you probably know, has threatened repeatedly. He's been forced to back down, but he's threatened repeatedly to break the visiting forces agreement with the United States. He has said over and over and over again, we will not get involved in a military confrontation with China, which would lead to the obliteration of the Philippines, even if it was a war with the U.S. and China, if the Philippines were lined up on the side of the U.S., and he's not going to do it. And General Lorenzana, his defense secretary, is not going to do it. He actually just attended the meeting in celebration, during the week of celebrations of the 100 years of the Chinese Communist Party, a phenomenal event overall. There was a meeting of political parties about, I think, July 6th, which Xi Jinping addressed. This was 500 different political organizations from around the world, 160 countries. So the idea that you got from Pompeo and Blinken that China is isolated is, of course, an absurdity. Uh-huh. The world is looking to China, to the Belt and Road, to the idea of finally breaking out from backwardness and lack of development through the Chinese approach, building infrastructure, which is the only way to break out of poverty and begin to develop modern industrial nations. This is what Duterte is looking at. This is what Lorenzana is looking at. These are people very familiar with the LaRouche organization ideas and have publicly stated so in many, many cases. There is an enormous anti-China sentiment being pumped up within the Philippines. Along the same lines that you see with the hysteria in the United States and Europe against China. But there is a growing international movement which is beginning to react. A lot of this, the reaction, is coming from the fact not only of the danger of war, but also because of the insanity of the Green New Deal policy, which is trying to force countries to literally shut down their coal-fired energy, which in many, many cases would just mean it would mean depopulation and genocide.
I want to pick up on that point. I think it's a really important point to perhaps elaborate more on. And Daniel Lazar, is the fact that what Mike Billington said, this mirage that China is isolated, where it's really the other way around, especially the fact that it just celebrated centennial, where so many countries came and shared China's 100 years. I mean, the U.S. is giving off that impression, and especially when it comes to, like, this project, the Belt and Road, which, by the way, the U.S. and the G7 countries cumulatively, I guess, had an answer for that. It's called B3W, I think is the initials for that, if I'm not mistaken. a U.S.-led Build Back Better world? Trillions of dollars, who knows where the money's going to come from? Anyways, that's a whole other topic, I guess. But China's not isolated. So how is the U.S. thinking that it's going to militarily be engaged with countries specifically in that region against China?
Well, look, Joe Biden's presidency is all about turning the clock back to the golden age before Donald Trump, when the U.S. Under Obama was the special nation, the unique nation that saw farther than anybody, the indispensable nation that saw farther than anybody else, that essentially had the power to make law as it saw fit. It would say jump, and the rest of the world would say how high. So America is trying to recapture that moment of hegemony. And so Biden is therefore striking out blindly against a whole long list of enemies, from Iran and Russia to China to Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, et cetera, et cetera. But he's unable to follow through, and the disaster in Afghanistan shows how completely exhausted the U.S. really is. The American public is war-weary. It doesn't want any more wars. It doesn't want its sons being sent to fight in countries that the ordinary American can't even find on the face of a map. So Americans don't want these policies. Yet Biden is trying to assert U.S. hegemony and getting nowhere. And that is the source of the conflict with Iran, with Russia, and with China as well. But the great danger here is that someone can make a misstep. I mean, a ship can probe into waters that China regards as its own territory, shots can be exchanged, lives can be lost, ships sunk, and before you know it, you are actually in a real shooting war. And that is very dangerous, and that is something the world should really resist before it goes over the brink. Well, I mean,
Go ahead, please.
I mean, I disagree with your other guests about about global warming. I think global warming is really quite real, and that's something that I think the world has to advance to a new industrial revolution where it moves beyond fossil fuels for the first time in more than two centuries. But that takes a collaborative international effort to raise technology to a whole new effort. And U.S. policies are completely opposed to that. The U.S. is not interested in collaboration, it's interested in confrontation. And that is becoming increasingly dangerous because we don't know what will happen if a spark goes off somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see over here. If we were to go on the premise, Mike Billington, that there is going to be there is going to be a military confrontation, even though you said LaRouche doesn't look at speculations as much. What kind of leverage does China have on the U.S.? We know about the a little over $1 trillion in debt, that the U.S. national debt that China owes, which is about 4% of that $28 trillion. Maybe its dominance on rare earth minerals over the U.S. can be used as leverage points. Is that what China has? Or maybe the technology aspect that China is moving forward with? I mean, what can China have against the U.S.? I mean,
your question sort of poses this as how do these two major nations confront each other and play games against each other? That's geopolitics. It's the idea that, you know, the only way you're going to get ahead is by undermining the other guy. If we do not end the British imperial view of geopolitics, which granted almost totally dominates the U.S. today, both parties. But nonetheless, if we don't break that, then we're going to have a war, and it's going to be a global economic holocaust, because we're already looking at the trillions of dollars that have been pumped into the system over these last few years to bail out these bankrupt banking institutions is going to blow up, and the threat of real hyperinflation has already begun. On the climate change issue, it's not climate change. This Green New Deal has nothing to do with the climate. It's being run by Mark Carney, the former head of the Bank of England, who's now the UN climate czar, with people like Mike Bloomberg. This is a bank policy, a central bank policy which says we are going to cut credit to fossil fuels and any industry or agriculture that does not obey our demand that they shut down anything productive. It has nothing to do with climate. Carbon does not affect the climate. It's the food for plants. And what we're seeing is a banking dictatorship of taking over the power of governments over their own economies and over the economies of the world. Mark Carney's lecture to the Africans that they must accept not developing their country and that they don't need to worry because they'll get carbon offsets. This is a colonial genocidal policy. Now, China's not going along with that. China gives a certain amount of lip service to the Paris Accord and so on. But they have made very clear they're going to be building hundreds of more coal-fired plants until they have nuclear power and hopefully fusion power within just a few decades.
I got to come in and give the last – I'm sorry to jump in there, Mike Billington, but the last question goes to you, Daniel Lazar. I know you have a reaction to what Mike Billington there said about coal. I'm sure you do. But overall, if you would like to answer that in a minute or less, and where is this confrontation leading to between China and the U.S.?
Well, the confrontation is heading off in an increasingly dangerous direction due to the Biden administration's determination to reassert U.S. hegemony. It wants to recapture the good old days when the U.S. was the dominant world power and all other countries were subservient. Those days are long in the past at this point. The world has moved on. China is a force to be reckoned with. It has a multiple, resources, economic, military, et cetera, that it can use to counter U.S. power. And the U.S. will only get in serious trouble if it tries to push China around and assert its own power in any kind of reckless, confrontational way. And that's what's so dangerous, because so far, the war party seems to be in control in Washington, and the war party is determined to embark on an ever more aggressive policy.
All right, very well. Thank you very much. Let me thank our guest, author and a leading figure in the LaRouche movement, and the Asia editor for the Executive Intelligence Review, Mike Billington, spoke to us from Hamilton, VA. Thank you. And journalist and author and political analyst, Daniel Lazar, there from New York. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. When we come with the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَجَعَلْنَا ابْنَ مَرْيَمَ وَأُمَّهُ آيَةً وَآوَيْنَاهُمَا إِلَى رَبْوَةٍ ذَاتِ قَرَارٍ
Made the son of Mary and his mother aside, and sheltered them within a high ground, having level areas and flowing water.
As you were with us, we were talking about the 50th verse of chapter Mu'minun. وَجَعَلْنَا ابْنَ مَرْيَمَ وَأُمَّهُ آيَةً وَأَوَيْنَاهُمَا إِلَىٰ رَبْوَةٍ ذَاتِ قَرَارٍ وَمَعِينٍ. We made the son of Mary and his mother aside, and we sheltered them upon a height quiet, secure and watered by a stream. Previously, we mentioned why he is called Ibn Maryam, Prophet Jesus, and why his name precedes that of his mother. But the interesting thing is that calling him Son of Mary draws our attention to the fact that he was conceived without participation of a father. And since this exceptional birth is related to both Jesus and his mother, both of them are counted as one sign, because his mother herself had an exceptional birth and was also exceptionally pure. They were in fact one truth in two different aspects. وَجَعَلْنَا بْنَ مَرْيَمَ وَأُمَّهُ آيَةً. They are together are called as one ayah and one sign. So different happenings of the universe throughout the history and strange events must be considered as seen as a means to reach the Almighty Allah's power, to understand how powerful He is, and to rely on Him in different hardships in our lives. Anyway, the verse mentions some of the blessings and favors bestowed upon Jesus and His mother. وَأَوَيْنَاهُمَا إِلَىٰ رَبْوَةٍ ذَاتِ قَرَارٍ وَمَعِينٍ. We sheltered them upon a height quiet, secure and watered by a stream. In this part of the verse, two important aspects of life in this world are mentioned. Water and security are from the necessities of living. But the Arabic word rabwa is derived from the word riba, meaning excess and increase. Here, it means a high land. The Quranic word ma'in means the flow of water. So, ma'in means running water. Some have considered it to be derived from the word ayn, meaning water, that is not hidden and can be discerned by eye. This sentence conveys to us the safe, comfortable, and peaceful place that Allah gave His mother, so that they would be safe from the plots of their enemies and could fulfill their duties peacefully.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The opinions of the interpreters are divided on the location of this site, where this verse is mentioning. Some believe that Nazareth was the hometown of Jesus, ala nabina wa alihi wa alayhi salam. From the time of his birth, some of the enemies that knew about his birth and his future role plotted to murder him. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala saved him and his mother by taking them away from their hometown and sending them to this secure place which was full of blessings. Some say that it refers to Egypt because Jesus and his mother had spent part of their lifetimes there, but it's only a probability. Another viewpoint, though, is that the site was in a desert in Palestine, and Allah had made it peaceful and safe for the mother and child by causing water to flow and provided them food from a dried-up date palm. However, this verse shows that Allah constantly supports His messengers and those who support them. Of course, the place where this verse is talking about is of great importance. But that's not the point the verse was sent down. When we deserve the protection of Allah, it would not matter whether or not all of our enemies combine against us. They would not have any power to harm us if He, subhanahu wa ta'ala, does not will it. The other and last point regarding this verse, dear listeners, to be noted, is that being isolated and lacking a physical support, or having only a few defenders, are no indicators of defeat. We should always stay hopeful of the Almighty Allah's help, and we should continue to try and strive in Almighty Allah's favor. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Why? And as when faith begins.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Round the world with reporters.
After 2 months of digging into a depth of more than 20 meters, Yemen's Mine Action Center managed to defuse one of the largest U.S. bombs dropped in Yemen's capital, Sana'a. The bomb was expected to target the civil defense building in Sana'a.
This GBU-24 bomb from the Paveway series was dropped in 2015 to target the civilian defense building in Sana'a next to Al-Farah Park and Al-Hasaba local market. The Saudi-led coalition has been using various types of advanced American weapons in its war on Yemen. This is a clear violation of the international humanitarian law.
Observers say this bomb is another proof of the U.S. military support for the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen.
We defused a GBU-24 bomb with a weight of 1.5 tons. The bomb targeted this hangar designated for the maintenance of Yemeni civil defensive fire trucks. The explosion of the bomb could have caused a humanitarian catastrophe with great consequences. The U.S. has provided only a few countries, including Saudi Arabia, with such a bomb.
Over the past years, Saudi Arabia has used internationally prohibited weapons, including the U.S. bombs, to target residential areas across the country. Back in April 2015, Riyadh committed one unforgettable crime by bombing the Attan area with a U.S. cluster bomb, killing more than 100 civilians, including women and children. This American bomb dropped by U.S. aircraft is yet another witness to Washington's role in the war crimes in Yemen, as the U.N. turns a blind eye to such violations. Besides the military support, Yemenis say Washington has always been backing Saudi Arabia politically as a major ally in the region. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Security situation is deteriorating day by day in Afghanistan due to the rising Taliban attacks, mainly on key cities and districts across the country. In an assault launched on Saturday, most of the suburbs of Ghazni city in southern Afghanistan came under Taliban control.
The attack pushed back Afghan forces into the city as they struggled to avoid the collapse of the strategic area, which is located very close to Kabul-Herat highway.
Officials in Ghazni say Afghan security forces are strongly resisting in the city, noting that dozens of Taliban militants, including foreign nationals, have been killed as a result of counter-attack operations by Afghan security forces.
The enemy has captured some areas in the suburbs of the city. This is because we tactically retreated from those areas. They also made efforts to enter the city, but we pounded them hard and pushed back the terrorists from the city.
This comes as thousands of locals have also stalled alongside the Afghan National Security and Defense Forces to resist against the Taliban, a move which has been supported by influential figures and locals in Afghanistan.
Our great nation has always proved to be alongside the country's national security and defense forces. Our people will once again resist against the Taliban now that the militant group wants to expand its military grip.
Apart from consequences like rising violence and bloodshed in Afghanistan, tens of thousands of local Afghans have so far been displaced inside the country. In such circumstances, many have urged both the Afghan government and the Taliban to rather focus on political solutions to resolve their difference than engaging in a deadly conflict. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Scores of Palestinian fishermen staged a protest against the ongoing Israeli violations against them in the Sea of Gaza. The Israeli siege imposed on the fishing area for 15 years has deteriorated the lives of Gazan fishermen who are dependent on the fishing industry and has badly affected Gaza's economy.
The raw materials required for repairing our nets and boats are not allowed to enter Gaza. This has deteriorated the condition of most fishermen in Gaza. For 15 years, the Israeli regime has intended to close down fishing zones in fishing seasons.
The fishermen syndicate in Gaza organized a protest in Gaza's port. There was also a press conference aimed at highlighting the Israeli abuse against fishermen, namely opening fire at them, arresting them, and droning fishing boats.
I lost my brothers and I lost my money and my source of income as the Israeli regime bombed my boat in 2014. And here I am, participating in this protest while human rights groups turn a blind eye to what is happening to us.
During the latest Israeli offensive on Gaza, Israel closed the sea completely. Since the end of the onslaught on 21st May, Israel has opened the sea for fishermen only for 6 miles, which is not enough for fishermen to get enough fish to help them make money or even provide enough fish for consumers.
The inhumane Israeli blockade has restricted our work for 15 years now. Most of fishermen now lack fishing nets and equipment due to the closure of borders. The Israeli regime is trying to destroy the Palestinian income by any means. The occupiers intend to make us isolated and restrict our daily work.
Under the Oslo Agreement, the fishing range was 20 miles. However, over the years, the Israeli military gradually reduced this range, severely damaging the livelihoods of thousands of fishermen. The humanitarian situation in Gaza is worsening due to the Israeli blockade, which is taking its toll on the life of 2 million Palestinians. Fishermen here in Gaza call on the international community to pressurize Israel to end these restrictions that threaten their daily lives and make it hard to maintain any source of income. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led coalition war against Yemen in 2015, thousands of Yemenis, including businessmen, have been forcibly displaced from Saudi territories due to their sympathy with their country. Others have been imprisoned and tortured on charges of being Houthis.
The Saudi authorities practice various types of violations against Yemenis residing in the kingdom. The number of forcibly displaced people from Saudi Arabia, according to the International Organization for Migration, has reached more than 49,000. Saudi Arabia began practicing enforced disappearance and torture of Yemenis because of their sympathy with the countrymen since the beginning of war. This is considered a clear violation of the international humanitarian law.
Abdul Latif al-Hashimi is one of those displaced from Saudi Arabia. He has established a foundation in Sana'a to expose the Saudi practices against Yemenis and to help those who feel alienated upon their arrival in Yemen after spending decades of their lives in Saudi Arabia. Al-Hashimi says some Yemenis have been displaced or imprisoned because of their last name if it refers to a Hashimi family.
There are Yemenis imprisoned in Saudi Arabia on charges of being Houthis belonging to a particular sect or because of their last name if it refers to Hashemite family. Even those who show sympathy with their countrymen suffering from the Saudi war and blockade are imprisoned. Others have their money and trade confiscated. We seek to help those who are deported to Yemen as most of them feel alienated upon their return to Yemen.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. The brutal war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children.
The grievance of forcibly displaced Yemenis from Saudi Arabia exposes another aspect of Riyadh's violations of the humanitarian law. People here say all this comes amid the apathy of most international human rights bodies. Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
More than 2,000 Palestinian teenagers have attended a summer camp held by the Islamic Jihad armed wing to get more familiar with the Palestinian cause and receive due military training for possible confrontation with the Israeli army.
The camp aims to raise the awareness of the Gaza teenagers about the Palestinian cause. Israeli regime thinks that by waging war, it can undermine the spirit of our nation. Camps like this make our children prepared to stand up for their rights against the Zionist violence.
The camp was inaugurated in a ceremony attended by a number of political and military leaders of the Islamic Jihad movement. The leaders said the camp seeks to make the new generation more familiar with the Palestinian cause and demolish the concept of normalizing ties with Israel in their minds.
This camp aims to give training to the young generation on the resistance front's war strategies against the Israeli regime. A number of participants have lost one or more relatives during the latest escalation, and they are here to learn how to cope with the next atrocities.
The number of participants this year was significantly higher compared to previous years. The resistance factions attribute this huge participation to the big victory they achieved against Israel in the last escalation over the Strip.
We came here to learn how to defend our lands. We want history to write about us and how we seek to liberate Jerusalem al-Quds. My message to the Israeli occupation is that the youngest olive tree in our land is older than your whole entity. We are the generation that witnessed wars and killings. And that's why we will keep the resistance and will not give up our land.
The Islamic Jihad says these camps also carry a message to Israel that the Palestinian factions are always ready to defend their rights. Observers here say among its responsibilities, the resistance front should narrate the true history of resistance for new generations to help them understand the true face of the Israeli regime. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Latest figures from the International Organization for Migration show so far this year 898 refugees have died in the Mediterranean Sea while trying to reach EU soil. That's three times more compared to the same period last year. The subject has, yet again, just been debated in the European Parliament.
Europe is no longer in a migration crisis.
That remark by EU Home Affairs Commissioner Ylva Johansson has incensed many lawmakers.
It is quite surprising to be here listening to this debate, and suddenly the Commissioner says the EU is no longer in a migration crisis. Commissioner, what planet are you living on?
Legislators and rights groups highlight reports that EU countries such as Greece and Italy are aggressively pushing refugee vessels away from their shores. Other EU nations like Austria and Hungary have closed their borders to these desperate people. A 6.3 billion euro fund has been agreed by the European Parliament to help member states manage the refugee issue.
We first need to see improvements in respect for fundamental rights and accountability, and this funding should be made conditional upon fundamental rights compliance.
The EU is continuing its policy of sending billions of euro to Turkey and Libya so that authorities there prevent the flow of refugees to the 27-nation bloc.
Throughout this, European leaders keep resorting to populist solutions of making it harder and harder for people to reach safety.
Campaigners say at no point since the crisis started in 2015 has the EU taken responsibility. They say the main source of the problem relates to attempts by Western powers to destroy and take over Syria. Now EU leaders are being urged to show some compassion and solidarity.
Finally, take political responsibility to break the deadlock in the Council and to agree on a common European asylum system.
However, rights groups say that is wishful thinking. Anti-refugee politicians such as Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban have the power to veto any proposals that are presented here. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The global call for reparations is growing louder by the day as news emerges that Jamaica's government is set to demand reparations from Queen Elizabeth II and the British government for Great Britain's role in the transatlantic slave trade. A petition has been prepared and will be submitted in due course, according to Olivia Bazby Grange, Jamaica's Minister for Culture. The announcement comes not long after UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet urged global action, including reparations, to, quote, make amends to people of African descent.
And of course, it's long, long, long overdue. And I like the way that the Jamaican representatives have phrased it. They have said, quite frankly, that if we're prepared, or if Britain is prepared to repay the enslavers or the descendants of the enslavers up until, just a few years ago, yeah, then they must equally be prepared to repay the descendants of the enslaved.
Over 3 million enslaved Africans were forcibly trafficked across the world by the British Empire to their colonies, including Jamaica, to work on plantations while being habitually brutalized and dehumanized. Yet for this heinous crime, the British state has never formally apologized, let alone taken steps to ensure reparatory justice.
Meanwhile, when slavery ended, the UK government borrowed $20 million from the Treasury to compensate slave owners for the inconvenience of not having enslaved Africans to make them rich. The loan was one of the largest in British history, which was equivalent to £17 billion today, and was at the time 40% of the UK's national budget. Yet according to the Daily Express newspaper based in the UK, 97% of their readers polled voted no to the question of whether Britain should pay reparations.
If you speak to the average Briton who doesn't know the true history of Britain, they're proud of empire. They think empire is something good. So the idea that they must, you know, make payment for their ill deeds, their wrongful deeds, that doesn't even occur to them.
Britain is not going to apologize because there is no compulsion to apologize. That's what we're dealing with. Reparations is ultimately about power, okay? It's not about right or wrong or what's just or unjust. It's about who has the power to enforce their will.
Jamaica is a small island nation with a population of just under 3 million that still has the British Queen as its unelected head of state. And while many people of African descent will welcome their latest demand for reparations, others will feel that it will take a lot more than a petition to get the British state to finally accept responsibility for their historic crimes. Ahmed Kabella, London.
A Muslim woman from Birmingham is considering legal action against West Midlands police after allegedly being arrested while chanting in support of Palestine on Tuesday. The story went viral on social media after footage of the arrest was shared by Palestine Action, who were staging a separate stunt opposite where the woman was cuffed.
Under what power are you taking her away? She was just standing on the street.
Three officers decided to come my way and start asking me to basically stop chanting. And then I challenged them and asked them, it's my right to chant. I'm outside the building. I'm not doing anything wrong. And they refused. They said, well, if you carry on chanting, then we will arrest you. And I said, well, what law have I broken? On what grounds? And they had no answer again. They were becoming very agitated, and I was speaking very calmly. And to my shock, one of the officers just grabbed my hand and handcuffed my wrist without any warning whatsoever. They were ignoring me, and then when I asked them, how long are you going to keep me in custody for, their reply was basically until the activists on the roof get down and when it's all over.
Where contacted the police for comment. They claimed she was arrested to prevent a breach of the peace and only de-arrested her after she was pressured to not return to the scene.
This story highlights the growth in tension between the state and pro-Palestine activism. Could we be witnessing the beginning of a British total ban on support for the Palestinian cause? The answer to that question could come if this activist decides to fight a battle in the courts. Robert Carter, Birmingham.
Near Beirut International Airport, the first thing that one would notice is the long queues of cars, which begin from the early hours of the morning. Police try to assist the station workers in organizing the lineup of all types of vehicles, which come to one of the few gas stations in Beirut which allow them to fill their tanks completely. People here are already fed up.
It doesn't get worse than this. I have a cab. I need to fill gas. I've been going around the entire city trying to find gas. I won't even mention the lack of medicine and food.
We are going to hell. They are humiliating us and leaving us with nothing. It is the politicians who are dependent on the West. They and the West are destroying this country.
Member of the gas station owner's syndicate tells Press TV the crisis is far from over.
The story of the fuel crisis begins with the governor of the central bank. If there is money, then he will allot funds. If he wants to humiliate people, then he uses his bureaucratic procrastination. While in such an economic crisis, they can work on providing the necessary funds in one day instead of 6, 7, or 9 days. One day of delay will cause delay in distribution.
Others believe there should be free commerce when it comes to importing fuel, and allowing anyone in Lebanon to import fuel and break the cartel's monopoly. The latest crisis does not stop there. Mohammed Qasim was a public high school teacher for some 40 years. Today, his pension is worth only 10% what it used to be.
I used to have 2,000 to 2,500
$500 per month. Now I'm gaining only $200. So how can it manage? This is one thing. $200 with what? Inflation, no food, no electricity, no fuel. Money is spent all over things other than social welfare. The government is not caring for people who are of low wages.
With so many unanswered questions and a complex socio-political and economic crisis, experts warn a possible Western intervention could worsen the situation.
Now they are trying to use the needs of the Lebanese in order to attract their emotions and passion towards these interventions. But I think this will not go on. None will accept that, and those who will accept that will pay for that nationally, and later will discover that he was making a betrayal to the country and to the history of the resistance that had liberated Lebanon.
Observers see prospects of civil unrest ahead, especially in light of the state's incapability of dealing with basic issues and the lack of agreement on a new cabinet. The Lebanese people have reached a state of anger and frustration, lining up for hours to fill their gas tanks. At times, this anger spills into fistfights and shootings. These incidents warn of the possibility of unrest and, as the caretaker prime minister put it, social explosion. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by famous Iranian Shiite orator and lecturer, Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
سعی بکنیم خونه رو تبدیل بکنیم به یه خونه با صفا و با صمیمیت. خونه امیرالمومنین و حضرت زهرا چنین.
We must do our best to establish a serene and pleasant atmosphere inside our houses. It is related that the house of Imam Ali and Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra was such. It is also mentioned that sometimes they took their food to the garden of Imam Ali to sit together and eat. They made a